Thank you for downloading the IA podcast. You can listen to all our episodes on Podbean, Spotify, Apple, and YouTube. Enjoy. The Chancellor Rishi Sunak delivered the autumn budget and the spending review this week, outlining his plans for the UK economy. It was a hefty budget with the Chancellor on his feet for over an hour, laying out spending commitments, reform to certain taxes, announcing new schemes and initiatives, and updating the nation on the health of the UK economy. The major talking points of Sunak's announcements were, firstly, the UK economy is forecasted to return to pre-COVID levels by 2022. The national living wage will increase by 6.6% to £9.50 an hour. Whitehall departments will receive a rise in overall spending, totalling £150 billion over the course of this parliament, and £6 billion of funding to help tackle the NHS backlog, and much, much more. To make sense of the budget and to work out what this means for households up and down the country, I'm delighted to be joined by Sam Collins, who is Senior Advisor to the Director General at the IA, and Darwin Friend, Policy Analyst at the Taxpayers Alliance. Welcome, Sam. Welcome, Darwin. So, guys, can I get your first overall impression of the budget? I'll start with you, Sam.
I mean, it's sad to say this from a Conservative administration, but I can't really think of much that would have been that was in this budget that wouldn't have been said by Gordon Brown in a slightly more Scottish accent. I mean, obviously, fantastic result for the IEA on the reform of alcohol duty. It's something that the IEA authors have been pushing for a long time. So two cheers for that. But to be honest, more, you know, mostly more taxes, more spending, and not a real appreciation of the scale of the debt that we find ourselves in. Mm.
Darwin?
Yeah, largely agree with Sam on that one. I mean, there were some concrete wins for taxpayers in there, but I don't think you can really hide the massive spending pledges that have been announced, which is going to really be eating into the fiscal headroom that we already have. But to mention a couple of things that the Taxpayers Alliance particularly have been campaigning on, we've got the cuts to business rates, the alcohol duties, cancellation of planned fuel duty hikes as well, which is pretty welcome news, I think, for families, entrepreneurs that are struggling under what is a historic high tax burden at the minute at a 70-year high that we've found, which is going to continue growing as well after this budget. And so I think really what the government now needs to focus going forward on is targeted tax cuts, more responsible spending, which will hopefully deliver that stronger growth and which will provide a much needed respite for taxpayers under this record high tax burden.
Yeah, and we'll get on to the nitty-gritty, and I'm sure you've got a lot more to say, both of you, about taxes. But I want to touch on the NHS and social curb. So we've announced, well, they announced before the budget, way before, that national insurance will go up to fund social care. And we were told that the initial funding from that would go to help NHS backlogs, after, and then after 3 years, I think it was, it would then go and fund social care. And the budget, at the budget, the Chancellor announced an extra £6 billion of funding for the NHS to help the backlog. You know, do you think, question to both of you, this is enough money for the NHS to get rid of the waiting list for treatment? Or is this going to be another, next year we'll have more money and the year after we'll have more money and our taxes will remain high?
Yeah, I mean, certainly I would hope it is. But I mean, one thing that the government didn't really talk about was what this £6 billion is actually going to be doing. Is it going to be giving us more doctors and nurses? Or is there a target, for example, that the government's got now that this £6 billion is going to pretty much relieve waiting lists by this year? They didn't really set that out yesterday. And I think my concern is very similar to yours, Kieran, which is it never seems to be enough money when it comes to the NHS. And I think from a Taxpayers Alliance point of view, taxpayers are quite rightly concerned that this is just going to be swallowed up by the NHS bureaucracy once again. I mean, we had the NI increase, national insurance increase, as you already mentioned, but I think what we need now is actually more fundamental reform of the NHS. And what we at the Taxpayers Alliance have suggested is that there be greater automation in the NHS, which could save well over £10 billion. And so I think that should have been the focus of the government yesterday rather than just throwing more money at it.
I couldn't agree more. As someone who moved over here from New Zealand, where we have quite a different healthcare system, it's always just been something that I found very difficult to understand, the reverence that people have for the National Health Service. I can understand wanting to have universal healthcare, and I applaud that, but the idea that the NHS is somehow unique or the only way of providing that universal healthcare just doesn't stand up to reality. So I think we do need fundamental reform of the National Health Service. The NHS, according to, I believe it was Mel Stride, the MP, who's the chair of the Treasury Select Committee, said yesterday that the NHS percentage of total government spending has gone up from 32% to 42%. Mm. So we're looking down the barrel of almost half of the entire government spending being on the National Health Service. And you're quite right to say that if it's not enough this time, I have no idea when it will be enough. But one more point I want to say on the national insurance increase is that I think we can safely now say that there will not be national insurance tax hike money for social care in, I think it was 3 years that the that it's supposed to switch from the NHS to social care, because obviously if the NHS needs more money now, then when in 3 years' time and the government starts calling for quote unquote a cut in the NHS budget in order to fund social care, then you just know that they're not going to have that political fight.
Yeah, I mean, just to put some figures on it, the basic rate taxpayers will pay an extra £180 a year when the national insurance rise comes in. So it's not small money for those on lower incomes. So moving on, though, this was a big spending budget. Total departmental spending will increase by £150 billion by 2024, which Rishi Sunak says is the largest increase this century. The Chancellor appeared to calm people's nerves about the economy, saying, and I quote, "Borrowing is down, debt is down, proving once again it is the Conservatives and only the Conservatives who can be trusted with taxpayers' money." Darwin, is this an accurate representation of where we are at, and you know, can we afford this spending?
I mean, yeah, the Chancellor is very keen to tout his spending credentials, and from this budget, there's definitely a lot to be touting, because there's a lot of spending going on, as you mentioned, £150 billion by 2024-25. And I'll give him some credit. I think it's welcome that he wants to see the debt and borrowing reduce and so on, but unfortunately, that's just not what the figures bear out that we saw yesterday. We've got tax receipts, so the amount of taxes coming in at 37% of GDP now. We've got spending at 52%. That's a record high since post-war, and the same goes for borrowing as well at 15%. And at the same time, our debt is at 95%, and that's only the debt that the government counts. For example, research we've done at the Taxpayers Alliance has actually seen the government debt estimated at almost £10 trillion, not the £2 trillion that the government claims. And so I really don't think the Chancellor actually gave necessarily the most accurate position of how the public finances are doing yesterday. And as Sam said at the start, I think Gordon Brown would have been very happy with this budget for sure. I mean, maybe he's actually been watching the BBC documentary they've put out recently, because there's a lot of policies I think that the New Labour would have agreed with as well. But I think going forward, there now needs to be a consistent focus from the government to be cutting taxes, to be making sure every bit of spending is as efficient as possible, because as we found at the Taxpayers Alliance, there was £6 billion in 1 year alone, and that's only what we found, so it's probably just the tip of the iceberg.
And yeah, just to add on that as well, I mean, the Chancellor was referring to headline debt, and he was using a different measurement, really, so he's been a bit cunning there to sort of frame it as debt is going down.
Well, I was just going to say on that as well. I mean, obviously, if you take account of also what the Bank of England is doing, then debt actually as a percentage of GDP rises well over 100%. And so that's quite an astonishing figure, I think. I saw yesterday that someone was saying, well, if you look at the average debt throughout UK's history from, I think, the 1700s, then it's around about 95%. And so we shouldn't be concerned, because we're essentially where we are at the minute. But this is the highest level since the 1960s in terms of debt. And okay, we've got record low interest rates at the minute. Inflation is now rising, but it's been low before. But if interest rates and inflation, for example, go up by a percent, that's another £23 billion on debt interest alone. And so this is eventually going to be hitting taxpayers hard. And we need to remember that this borrowing isn't free.
No, absolutely. I couldn't agree more with you, actually, because I think I don't really care which particular version of debt the Chancellor refers to in his budget speech, because the one that actually matters is, as you referred to, Darwin, the unfunded mandates that we're looking down the barrel of, you know, over the next 40, 50 years. We have pensions liabilities that are, in many cases, drastically underappreciated by the government. The IA released a paper this week that if you were to extrapolate the gap in budgeted pension contributions versus what has actually had to be paid out. Yeah. There was a 17 billion, so in the NHS, it's, I believe, £17 billion. If you to extrapolate that across the entire government, it's £57 billion a year of that is currently unfunded and unbudgeted for. And so we are in a lot of trouble. And I think that unless the government starts trying to be honest about the real scale of the debt, and people, at the moment, it seems like people are assuming that the government can spend as much as it wants. And the entire conversation is on, why don't you spend more on this? Why don't you spend more on that? $6 billion more for the NHS? Fine, fantastic. You know, throw it on the pile. But really, there needs to be a lot more honesty from the government and, frankly, from other groups as well, such as the media, about the real state of things.
Absolutely. And I'd like to move on to universal credit now. So the Chancellor said he would reduce the taper rate of universal credit. This affects the amount of money lost by working claimants if they earn more through work. So currently the taper rate is 63%, which means that if you earn an extra pound, you lose 63p in benefits. Rishi Sunak plans to reduce this taper to 55%. Do you think this is a positive step for those on lower incomes to keep more of their money? Is this welcome?
Yes, definitely. they should always, if we're going to have a benefit system, the last thing that we want is for it to disincentivize work. We want people, it's not just the economic benefit, it's also the mental health and social benefit of being in a job rather than being on benefit if you can. Obviously, if you're someone who's unable to work, then the state, you know, it's the role of the community, either through the state or through some sort of private scheme, to support you. But if you are able to work, we should be having, we should be putting regulations and a welfare state in place that makes it easier for you to get into work and to benefit from it.
Yeah, and I agree, and I think the Conservatives really didn't have to deal with this issue of universal credit to begin with, and so I think it's quite right of them to actually try and be making work pay. And many on low incomes, I think personally, are really going to be welcoming this decision because there is a cost of living issue right now. And we haven't done any in-depth research on this yet, so I think there does still need to be a lot of analysis into the detail of what they proposed yesterday. But I would hope that it will help those both on universal credit and those aren't. And obviously those on universal credit are also paying taxes as well. So I think for both of those groups, I think the priority has to be that they're both essentially receiving a fair deal as taxpayers. And hopefully this announcement will do that.
Yeah, so a bit of consensus there on the universal credit announcement was a good move by the government. Another thing that I think would be warmly welcomed was the announcement of a charter for budget responsibility. Rishi Sunak has confirmed he will publish a new charter for budget responsibility aimed at keeping the government on the path of discipline and responsibility. As part of the budget, it compromises of two fiscal rules. The first rule is that underlying public sector net debt, excluding the impact of the Bank of England, again, very clever, must, as a percentage of GDP, be falling. The second is that in normal times, the state should only borrow to invest on future growth and prosperity. It seems like common sense. It's, you know, I don't know why this has to be in writing. Everyday spending under the new charter must be paid through taxation. Surely for fiscal hawks who are concerned about this, this is a positive move, but is it worth the paper it's written on, Darwin?
I mean, I hope so. I mean, we've gotten used to these fiscal rules under the Conservatives. I remember George Osborne introducing a host of them when he became Chancellor in the 2010s. And so, I mean, I would have thought this was just common knowledge. You shouldn't be spending money. You shouldn't be borrowing more than you should probably be able to get out of the tax system. And obviously, keeping debt low, as I mentioned before, is really important, because every penny we spend on debt interest is a penny that's not being spent on taxpayers' priorities, which this government has said all the time is what it's looking for and what it got elected on in 2019. In terms of the rules, though, I think we're probably going to have consensus on this one. Personally, I mean, we have already discussed the debt and borrowing there. Even if you take the government's measures, they're at $2 trillion and over $300 billion respectively from the last financial year. And so actually getting those things under control, and it was welcome, I should say, that the borrowing figures are going to be going down throughout the rest of the forecast period. But I think the government really does need to just try and get more of a handle on it, because as I've mentioned, every single penny that they're borrowing is going to add to the debt, and that eventually has to be paid for. And if it's not going to be by this generation, then it's going to have to be by future generations. And the longer they leave it, the more interest is piling up on it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we have consensus over the fact that this is a good thing, but frankly, to pour some cold water on your optimism, Kieran, this is, I believe, the fifth set of financial rules we've had since 2010. There was another set of financial rules before that for Gordon Brown. So I really am not particularly confident that this is going to be the silver bullet. You know, I have no reason to think that this time suddenly having a set of fiscal rules is going to keep is going to get us back to a balanced budget. I mean, even in the United States, where they have constitutional amendments requiring balanced budgets, you still see them fiddle the figures if they feel like they want to or need to in order to avoid having to balance the budget. Frankly, the important thing is mindset. So long as the government thinks that its role is to step into all parts of human activity and pay for it, you know, and pay for various programs that really ought to be dealt with by the private sector, then I don't really think these fiscal rules will make a huge difference. Sorry.
No, I mean, when the next crisis comes, I'm pretty sure these rules will be thrown out the window very quickly. One of the most eye-catching measures in the budget was a 50% cut in business rates for hospitality for 1 year. It's reportedly worth $1.7 billion. There will be a change in the business rates multiplier as well, which will lower business rates bill by just under $1 billion a year. Firstly, this is a great step to help the hospitality business. I think we can all agree on that. But should this not be like rolled out to other bricks and mortar businesses who have equally struggled during the pandemic?
I mean, yes, but frankly, one of the weirdest moments of the budget speech yesterday was a Tory Chancellor standing up and chiding the Labour Party for actually wanting to abolish an inefficient and distortive tax. The IEA's done research on, so I'm sure the Taxpayers Alliance has as well. Business rates are incredibly distortionary, and then the government is constantly trying to play catch up in order to offset the costs. For example, like this, you have an emergency, but that doesn't change the value of the properties that the businesses are residing in. So therefore, therefore these businesses need huge amounts of relief, and this keeps happening time after time. And frankly, it would be better off if they just abolished it and replaced it with a land value tax or something similar on the underlying property. On the policy itself, I mean, fine, yes, good. There is a distortion risk that, you know, if it just applies to certain industries, certain business types, that businesses in similar but not identical sectors will, you know, open a little cafe on their premises in order to attempt to benefit from this. But frankly, we need something a bit bigger than just fiddling around the edges.
So would you agree we need reform, not just tinkering at the sides, Don?
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, I think the reforms yesterday were quite a big win in terms of what we've been calling for, especially for the business rates system, if it's going to be maintained as it currently is, really. I think it is good because it is one of the most damaging taxes, essentially, for firms, and especially if the government is concerned about our high streets as well, which they seemingly are, then I think this is going to be a big win for those businesses. We've called for in the past re-evaluations every 3 years instead of five, and so that would be able to make essentially the system a bit more reactive to what's going on, as Sam mentioned earlier. And I think in terms of the multiplier, for example, I mean, the small business rate multiplier was almost at 50p. I mean, that's crazy, firstly, in my opinion. And even the normal rate, that was 51.2p. And a blog that we wrote recently actually showed that the multiplier had increased by almost 10p in 10 years. And so welcoming the fact that they're cancelling a cut or making a cut to the proposed increase to that is a good thing, especially because we did a little bit of a budget roadshow before the budget, getting out there and talking to real people on their high street. And one lady in Newport in particular spoke to us, and she was just saying how much business rates really impact her business. And so while I agree with Sam, there's more to be done. I think what the government did yesterday was a good first step in reforming business rates. And all I can say is I hope there's more to come.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. I shouldn't be too I shouldn't be so hard on the government on that. But because there's one other thing, one point I do want to make is that one thing that was nice not to see in the budget, as a response to business rates, was an online transactions tax. An online sales tax, which had been trailed pretty heavily. It's not a done deal that it won't come back later on. I mean, they keep sort of hinting at it, but it was nice to see that the government is trying to solve the problems on the high street through cutting taxes rather than imposing new taxes on online distributors.
No, I absolutely agree. I did a paper on this which came out last Christmas, really. And I think, I mean, there is a consultation I think I saw yesterday that could be on an online sales tax. So I think it still potentially could happen. But I think, as we both know, if there's going to be an online sales tax, then there's going to be increased prices for consumers. We've seen that from international examples, whether that be what France tried to do by imposing a digital sales tax, what India tried as well with its equalization levy that saw costs go up for businesses and then consumers as well. And I think, given that we know that there's a cost of living crisis, there's a tax burden at a record high as well, I think the last thing taxpayers need now is even more taxes, when I believe the bottom 10% are actually paying 57% of their gross income in taxes already. So we need to be making things easier for them, not harder.
Yeah, and moving on to a subject I know will be greeted very well. The IEA got a mention at the dispatch box when the Chancellor unveiled the wide-ranging reform to alcohol duties. He referenced IEA research, which said that alcohol duty, and I quote, defies common sense. So some positive movement on this issue. In a nutshell, duties will be simpler. I think they're going down from 15 to 6. And there's essentially, the stronger the drink, the higher the rate. Darwin, I'll go to you first, because I know the Taxpayers Alliance also does work on alcohol duties. I'm guessing you welcome that as well.
Really welcome it. And even outside of our Quids In campaign, which has really been calling for this tax cut to support our pubs and our hospitality industry, which has understandably been battered throughout COVID, I think it's just welcome that the government is making tax simpler. We've got one of the most complex tax systems in the world, I believe. So actually anything that they can do to make that simpler and easier to understand for business is welcome. And even from a consumer point of view, I know there was some concern at the Taxpayers Alliance about the increase it's going to have on red wine, but I think there was also a lot of praise for it from a colleague that I have in Kent that I think a couple of us may know about, how it's going to be cutting the price of some sparkling wine as well. So I think there's benefits all round for people that enjoy having a drink.
Absolutely. It was very nice to have the Chancellor name check us at the dispatch box. Some of the other things that he suggested in the budget, I kind of wish he'd read a bit more of our stuff rather than just the stuff on tobacco taxes. On alcohol duties. It's just great to see that the government making any effort to simplify the tax system, reduce cost of living for most people, obviously not red wine drinkers, who I'm very sorry that the Taxpayers Alliance is going to be in trouble on that. But it's just great to see the government taking a positive action. It would have been nice, considering the Chancellor spent, I believe, about 10 minutes talking about simplifying alcohol duties, that he would have maybe appreciated that idea could have been spread across the rest of the tax system. We've got, as you said, one of the longest and most complex tax systems in the world. I believe it's 10, 12 times the length of the King James Bible. So it's a very impressive document. And frankly, we should be really trying to cut away that and get something closer to the Hong Kong tax code, which I believe is about 1/48th the length of the British one. So if we could do, I'd say fantastic, great job, Rishi. Go on.
Cheers to that. he's also made some movement on other taxes, using post Brexit freedoms. Air passenger duty, as I understand it, will be cut between domestic flights in the UK. Which is good, and a tonnage tax on imports. Well, ships that are flying the Red Ensign apparently will get better tax rates. Is that another win, right, Darwin?
Yeah, I mean, to start with the second one first, I think the tonnage tax is a bit of a smaller thing, a bit of flag-waving patriotism, perhaps. But I suppose if a British merchant ship is paying less tax than as the Taxpayers Alliance, then it can only be a good thing. But I think the real focus should be on the APD cut, which on domestic flights is going to be 50%, which I think especially for Northern Ireland could really help them. And I appreciate this wasn't potentially the politically the easiest thing for the government to do, especially with COP26 coming up next week. So no, we really welcome this because we put in a response to their consultation on APD rates, recommending pretty much exactly the same thing. The only thing I wish they hadn't have done is probably increase the tax for the longer haul flights, but definitely a win for taxpayers that domestic flights are going to be seeing that tax cut.
Mm. I mean, maybe it's because I'm a New Zealander, so I'm grumpy that it's going to be more expensive for me to fly, to fly back and see my family. But I mean, it was, I agree that it's good to see EU rules being unwound, to see the government actually take advantage of the opportunities from Brexit. I mean, whether you voted Leave or Remain, the point of Brexit wasn't the end itself, it's the opportunity that it gave the British government to radically reform various things of EU rules that we didn't like and that didn't work for us. And so it's good to see the government taking advantage of that. I agree with Darwin that it's politically sensitive, considering we're just coming up to COP26, and that but I think the government hasn't really answered the question. And we did a paper I believe last year actually arguing for the abolition of air passenger duty, amongst other things, because no one can really explain what air passenger duty is for anymore. It started off as just an additional duty. Then it's kind of morphed into a green tax, according to some of the proponents. Mm. And yet here we are, while trying to get to net zero, and apparently making it cheaper to fly around the United Kingdom. At the same time, the government keeps saying that we should be taking more trains and is spending billions and billions of pounds building HS2, to the point where it's almost cheaper to knock down Birmingham and bring it 20 minutes closer, 20 minutes closer to London. So, it's great, but it's just all a bit odd, and it seems to indicate a lack of joined-up thinking in government, which I hope isn't going to be some sort of new offset in, 6 weeks' time, because suddenly we need to find a way to reduce the carbon footprint that's this passenger duty cut could increase.
Yeah, I mean, completely agree with you, obviously, on HS2. That's something the Taxpayers Alliance is very passionate about changing, shall we describe it as. But I agree with you as well in terms of APD. Very similar, I think, actually, in a way, to the business rates reform. I think what they announced yesterday should be a good first step towards a large goal, whether that be in terms of business rates for even more reform, but especially in terms of air passenger duty, it should be in terms of getting towards abolishing it. I think it's served its time, and changes needed.
Well, I think, we've had our positive segment. I think we need to be brought back down to earth now. Because there was an absence of any meaningful tax cuts and deregulation in the budget. Some sober reading, the tax burden is at its highest since the post-war Attlee government. Some stats here that were reported in the Times this morning. Every household in Britain is paying £3,000 more in taxes since Boris Johnson became Prime Minister. The Resolution Foundation said real wages will fall next year, and the UK was in the midst of its weakest decade for pay growth since the 1930s. Should he have used his fiscal headroom to cut taxes rather than spending as he did yesterday, Dawn?
Well, that's certainly brought the mood down, I think. But no, I completely agree with you in terms of the statistics. I think I mentioned earlier the fact that the bottom 10% are paying well over half their gross income in taxes already, and it doesn't look like it's going to be getting any better either for them. So that's a big concern. I mean, the one to try and make it a little bit more positive, I suppose, then there was a welcome tone from the Chancellor that potentially towards the end of the Parliament and into the next election, there could be some tax cuts, which would be very welcome. In terms of the research we put out yesterday, I think next year we're going to be at a 71-year high tax burden as a result of the announcements made in this budget. And this is something we started doing in 2018, I believe it was, where we started off with it being a 50-year high tax burden, and no one was really picking it up and paying attention to what we were saying. But ever since then, it seems to be getting a lot more traction. I mean, even the BBC last night, I saw Hugh Edwards was talking about how there was now a 70-year high tax burden as a result. And so I think even the mainstream media is now starting to understand that this is a real problem for people across the country. And what's worse is the fact that this is at a time when we've theoretically got a low tax Conservative government. So I think what we really now need to be seeing is not the government just touting its credentials anymore. We actually need to be seeing some firm action to make sure that taxpayers are getting the fairest deal that they can do out of the government.
I mean, it's the I keep coming back to in my mind to, I think Boris Johnson said something on the lines of he had an emotional commitment to low taxes, which it's all very well, and I obviously applaud it. But frankly, all it seems to mean is that he raises taxes but feels sad about it. So
as do I.
As do we all. I think it just goes to show to carry on. I mean, everything Darwin said is absolutely correct, but goes to show that whenever people talk about having a large state or large amounts of government spending, populists on the left always like to pretend that this is that the way to pay for it is you just tax the rich. You know, it's only the rich people who will suffer from having a large state and a burdensome tax system. But actually, as we discussed, you know, as Darwin said, you know, it's the poorest 10% who are paying 57% of their income in taxes, and so this is. This just goes to show that unless we can start to bring down the size of the state, this tax burden is only going to get worse and heavier. And frankly, we're not even balancing the books now. So imagine how much worse it's going to get if suddenly we need to find billions of extra pounds for when interest rates go up and we need to pay more to service the debt. Mm. Not to mention when the NHS next comes knocking on the door for more money, more funding as well. So I just agree with Darwin. It's a very sad situation. Now I'm depressed.
And I mean, and to add to that, even the forecast period, I think, for borrowing was not showing a budget surplus at all. I think it was levelling off at, I believe it was around about 2 billion or so. Yes. Some figure around about there. And so, like I say, I think the government knows this, but there is definitely more that can be done to actually just make sure that those hard up families and businesses that I think has been the theme throughout our conversation during this chat has are really put first. Actually, I understand that the tendency can sometimes it's the easier decision to make a spending decision now, and then that might make your life a little bit easier in the short term. But I think what we really now need to be looking at is the long term benefit of tax cuts rather than the short term impacts potentially on the exchequer. It's actually the long term that matters, because that's then going to be the costs that our children and grandchildren children are paying, rather than the political easiness of making those decisions now.
I suppose one thing we should be grateful for is that we are potentially looking at a general election either next year or the year after, which you would hope would incentivize the government to bring forward some tax cuts before polling day.
Well, that brings us back to the Brownite budget days, I believe.
So maybe it's an argument for 3-year parliamentary terms that would mean we get more tax cuts. Sorry.
No. I just want to very quickly just comment on, it was quite a good budget for those in the public sector. I mean, we've spoken about our chairman's paper, Neil Record's paper, showing that, public sector pensions are soaring, there's a massive funding gap, and the deal that public sector pensions, get a good deal for your pension compared to, private sector. The public sector pay freeze was ended, which, is going to see good wage increases. Do you think, the private sector has been left out in this budget? I mean, I know there was an increase in the national living wage. You can argue that's a bad thing, really, for private small businesses who not only have to deal with a higher national insurance contribution bill, but also now have to up their wages. Just quickly, Darwin, do you think there is a bit of a divide now between how the public sector has been treated compared to the private sector?
Yeah, potentially, for sure. I mean, in terms of what we were talking about, for example, on alcohol duty earlier, I think I saw something yesterday that was saying because of the wage changes they're making, it could actually mean that the price of a pint or something goes up by 30p, which kind of is a lot more than the tax cuts are going to benefit people. So potentially in terms of that. But when it comes to public sector pay, definitely. I mean, let's look at the benefits that public sector workers have. They're getting a pay rise now. So the public sector pay freeze is gone. They've got their pension benefits when they leave. There's usually quite a nice golden handshake to make sure they've got a comfortable exit. And then they've also got the job security that the private sector don't have. And so I think there needs to actually be more of a balance by the government to ensure that the benefits of employment for both private and public sector workers are level, at least.
I'm going to be a teeny bit of a wet on this, because I think the problem with the public sector isn't so much what staff faces that there's too many of the wrong sort of staff employed in the first place. It seems that there's far too many people earning large amounts of money who will also benefit from the public sector pay freeze ending. But I don't object to people in the NHS, in local councils, who actually put in a hard shift and do jobs that we really need them to do, getting paid a reasonable wage. And I can appreciate that there has been a lot of public sector wage freezes over the past 10 years during the Cameron government and more recently. So I'm not, although I think it's bad for the public finances, and frankly, probably we'd be better off if we outsourced some of those jobs to the private sector and let wages be set by the marketplace rather than by the state. I don't want to sort of automatically rule out the benefit this will bring to a lot of low income people who happen to work in the public sector and have had their wages squeezed quite badly.
Mm. No, I generally agree with Sam there actually on that. I don't think it's the case that obviously public sector workers should never have a pay rise. Of course not. I do think that the public finances, as we mentioned earlier, were in quite a dire state. So whether now was necessarily the right time for that, that's up for debate. Mm-hmm. I think from the Taxpayers Alliance point of view, really, it's the concern for, as Sam was saying, those on the top pay. And we do a lot of work on this, especially regarding local authorities. We have a town hall rich list out every year, and it just seems to always be growing, the number of people that are earning six-figure salaries and the number of people that are earning more than the Prime Minister mm-hmm. themselves. And so I think what there really needs to be a focus on is making sure that there's value for money out of every single public sector worker who's receiving that pay rise, but most of all out of the executives who are who are getting the biggest salaries of them all.
Yeah, so sorry, just one more point on that. In 2010, the IA published a book called Sharper Axes, Lower Taxes, which looked at how we could radically reform the size of the state. And in that, we talked about the National Health Service and the increase in managers, people of managerial rank between, you'll have to forgive me if I don't get these exactly right, but I believe it was 1991 and 2011 was the increase in managers. And if you were to just dial back the managerial staff to at what it had been, even assuming the same levels of pay, there wasn't a penny taken off any of their wages, even if you just dial back the headcount to the same level as it was in the 90s, then you would save something like a £1.7 billion a year, and that was in 2010. And so I can only imagine that what it would be if you were to do the comparison now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just want to get, this is the final question for today's podcast. Interesting headline in the Telegraph. The headline said, "The budget marks a philosophical shift in conservatism," says Treasury Minister. Just one last thought from both of you. Is this now, have we returned to a almost sort of post-war consensus and Butskillism, consensus on how the economy should be run? And what does this mean for free marketeers in Britain? And I'll start with you, Sam.
Yes, I do actually think that the fact that we've both suggested that this is a budget that could have easily been given by Gordon Brown indicates that the where the centre ground is in politics has moved radically since the days of Margaret Thatcher and even the early years of Tony Blair. I mean, up until I think 2001, Tony Blair ran a very tight ship as far as the size of the state and spending was concerned. So I agree. I think it's going to be a really tough few years for free marketeers, but of course that's why groups like Taxpayers Alliance and the IA exist, so that we can really try and push the Overton window back in our direction.
Darwin?
Yeah, unfortunately we're ending on a less positive note, I suppose, but I would largely agree with Sam on that. We seem to be going back to, I mean, you could argue even in terms of when we talked about spending and so on like that things are actually worse than they were in terms of the post-war consensus, because now we're going back to wartime expenditure levels almost. Yeah. So I definitely agree with Sam. It seems to be that the future is going to hold probably less positive news for those at the IEA and the Taxpayers Alliance. But I think that only makes the messages that we push even more important, because at the end of the day, it's, as we've been talking about, it's taxpayers, it's those people up and down the country who are having to deal with their own family budgets that are going to be the ones that need every penny they can. And I think if the government focuses on cutting taxes as it says it wants to and making sure it's more fiscally controlled, then like I say, I think it could be a brighter future ahead.
Well, I think that's a great place to end. Thank you to Darwin Friend from the Taxpayers Alliance and Sam Collins from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to the IA podcast on Podbean, Spotify or Apple. We also upload our podcast on our YouTube channel, IA London. If you want to help contribute to the IA's digital output, please support us on Patreon, where you can benefit from exclusive membership perks whilst helping us continue to produce stimulating educational output. To become an online patron, click the link in the show notes.